nice to find out others who have gifts in the church and willing to use them to the blessing of the body. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 6. We're concluding our series tonight on how God's servants respond to crisis. I felt so good this morning with my coat off. I think I'm going to take it off again tonight. Try not to make that a regular habit, but you think it's hot out there. You ought to feel it up here under these lights. Reminded of the little poem I ran across some time ago. Down the street his funeral goes. As sobs and wails diminish, he died from drinking straight shellac, but he had a lovely finish. And I hope our finish tonight is that good. There will not be copies of that made, by the way. You know, I ran across a letter this week. Actually, it came to the church here. And I thought I would share part of this with you, because sometimes we think we're the only ones who have problems, crises. And this letter is from Missionary Aviation Fellowship, which we frequently get mail from them. But this one particularly struck me, and I guess God wanted me to read it. So many of the letters I don't take the time to read. But this one the Lord, for some reason, wanted me to read. It says, "Dear friend, the events of the past few days make me wonder if God may be preparing us for something greater than we can possibly imagine. But for now, I only have sad news to report. First, there was the July the 20th accident in Cameroon, West Africa. I hastily added a P.S. about it on my information letter to you just a few days ago. Our pilot, George Wall, two missionaries, and an African national were killed. Two other passengers were injured. Then during a meeting in Santa Barbara, California, for the encouragement and rejuvenation of our missionary staff, a huge fire forced our evacuation. I'm pleased to report there were no injuries. We were able to finish our time together at another location. Now, just recently, I have received word that one of our planes crashed and burned while landing at an airstrip in a rugged area in the deep interior of Iran Jaya, Indonesia. Pilot Chris Davison, together with a missionary couple and their two youngest children, were all killed." I think this reminds us that there are even those organizations which have their problems and crises. And the writer of this letter is right. You know, he feels there's something good that's about to happen, that the Lord is allowing these things to come into their lives. We saw it this morning in Daniel chapter 3, how as a result of the crisis, God caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper even to a far greater degree and to be elevated to even greater positions and have greater respect among all of their Babylonian countrymen. As we look at Daniel chapter 6, I mentioned this morning, we're going to have the same outline, and we really do, because we basically got the same message as we had this morning. It's interesting how closely these two accounts parallel one another. You know, one of the things that really strikes me when I read Daniel chapter 3 is I wonder where Daniel is. You know, here are these three Hebrew children that are supposed to bow down and worship this great image that Nebuchadnezzar had constructed, but there's no record of where Daniel was. One can only conjecture that because of his great position in the empire, being over, second only to the king himself, he was ruler throughout all of Babylon. He may have been on some kind of a business trip that he wasn't there at the time. We don't know. When I read Daniel chapter 6, I wonder where are the three Hebrew children. That's just reversed. No record of where they are. Remember, they were men of influence as well. And it's very possible that they too may have been out of town, some speaking engagements or someplace that they couldn't be there. And so consequently, Daniel's left holding the bag. You can only surmise on that as far as what happened. As we looked at Daniel chapter 5, and I just briefly mentioned that this morning, the kingdom now changes hands. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest of all of the kings of Babylon, and now after Nebuchadnezzar's death, the kingdom begins to dissipate and waste away in strength and power. And finally, Belshazzar, when he takes the throne, you see Belshazzar here now as being one of the most wicked kings and unconcerned about what's going on around him. When the nation is right in the midst of a great crisis here. Here he is in his own palace, drinking it up with those closest to him and having their dancing women and their good times. In the same hour of the night, the handwriting appears on the wall, and at that very same time, the Lord allows Cyrus the Great, the Persian leader, great Persian king, to come in now. And it's an interesting account just to read of how Cyrus actually captured the city of Babylon. But now Persia just sort of swallows up the great Babylonian Empire, and the Persian Empire becomes even greater now in its initial greatness. And so, but the exciting thing is that here's Daniel passing from one empire to another, and he's really untouched. And that's what we have if you look at the last verse of Daniel chapter 5. The same night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62, and it seemed good to appoint 120 satraps, in verse 1 of chapter 6, over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. And who does he put in charge of these but Daniel the prophet? And I think that's always been a verse and a thought of great encouragement to me, that even though we in our country may go through some very difficult times, even to the point of seeing our country just fade away in power and ultimately be taken over possibly by a foreign power, yet the Lord's promise is he really looks out for his own people. And Daniel's a good illustration of that. Like Noah, who was preserved from the judgment of the flood. Like Lot, who was taken out of Sodom, Gomorrah, when they were destroyed. And on throughout the Bible, those men who are really faithful to God and stand for what they believe to be right and seek to please God in every situation, God honors them by allowing them to pass from one economy to another, from one situation to another, really untouched by judgment. Now, if we divide this chapter up, you'll see in verses 1 through 9, it's a paragraph, and ultimately it presents to us the crisis. Then in verses 10 through 18... we have the response of Daniel. And then in verses 19 through 28, we have the result and how God used this not only in Daniel's life to prosper him, but also to gain a greater respect with the king and also with his fellow men. Now, Darius the Mede in chapter 5 and verse 31... actually is not the great king of the Persian Empire. Cyrus is the great king even at this time, but Darius is the one who is put over the province of Babylon. That's actually where he becomes the leader, and so it's kind of wrong in one sense of the word to look at him as the king. He wasn't the sovereign king. Cyrus was the great leader of the whole empire, but Darius was the one who was put over the Babylonian part of it. And so Darius immediately in verse 1 appoints these 120 satraps who were also men of great influence, but over them he puts Daniel. And you'll notice that these satraps in chapter 6 verse 2 might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel became distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Now, Daniel's not yet appointed to this, but the king had great plans because he noticed that Daniel had an extraordinary spirit. And that verse has always been a blessing to me, that here was Daniel who was really developing a relationship with God, and because he was, there was just a quality about his life that set him apart from his counterparts, from his colleagues. He was just a man that God had really elevated here in spirit. So he was an extraordinary man, having an extraordinary spirit. Then in verse 4, the commissioners and satraps begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. We can almost picture here some kind of an Senate investigating committee that they decided, because Daniel was a man who had an extraordinary spirit and he was certainly bound towards greatness, and the king was one day going to take him and elevate him in position over them, that they must find something against Daniel. And so they look. And they look very hard in verses 3 through 5. But in verse 4, the last phrase, they could not find any ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. Isn't that interesting? In the light of our government problems of the last few years and all of the corruption that we've found in our government, yet as far as governmental affairs were concerned, Daniel comes out with a clean bill of health. And they had gone over him with a fine-tooth comb. In every accusation, he was found faithful. No negligence or corruption was to be found in him. So in verse 5, these men, as they further put their heads together, without Daniel being there, they say, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." Now here's what happens. Because Daniel's life out here in society was so perfect, they could find no accusation against him. And I think that's really a testimony to all of us that we not only can be faithful to God, but we can be faithful out here in society too, and we don't have to be corrupt like everybody else is. And so Daniel is found to be faithful. And they knew the only way they could get at him was by coming up with some kind of a law in which he would ultimately have to choose between the king and between his God. So this is what they do in verse 6. They came by agreement to the king and they said, "King Darius, live forever." You know, that must have, you would call that flattery. You know, "King, we love you so much and we just think you're such a fine king that we hope you'll live forever." And they're sort of buttering him up for the kill here because, you see, Darius loved Daniel. He really thought very highly of Daniel, as the passage further brings out. And there was no way that Darius wanted to see Daniel slain. So, "King, live forever." Verse 7, "All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governors, have all consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den." Now that all sounds very good to the ears of the king because it looks as though they're really doing him a great honor here. So in verse 8, "Now, O king, establish the injunction, sign the document so that it not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." This was a policy throughout the Medes, and especially in the Persian Empire, that laws once established could not be altered, could not be changed. So in verse 9, the king signed the document, that is, the injunction. So there we have the immediate crisis. Daniel is either going to have to give up in principle what he believes to be right in practice. His life was one habitual devotion to God. He was completely given over to doing the Lord's will. God had elevated him to this position of great respect and honor among his colleagues. And now Daniel finds that he's in a position where he's either got to compromise or stay true to his convictions. And what does he do? It's a real crisis. Verse 10. "Now Daniel knew that the document was signed. He entered his house. In the roof chamber, he had windows open towards Jerusalem. He continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously." I was talking with someone who I don't believe is here tonight as I look around, but this week he was sharing with me that in a job opportunity they have, the immediate thing that he was faced with was having to do something that was illegal. Not that bad, but just a little bit. As he was sharing this with me, I was amazed at his convictions. His wife and he were both sharing this with me, of how they were going to stand, even though it meant that he may not get the job. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of spirit that Daniel had. And they're waiting to find out tomorrow whether or not he's got the job any longer because he wouldn't go along with what these people wanted him to do, knowing that it was illegal. So in verse 10, Daniel decides he cannot do it. He continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day. Now, I think we're making too much here when we say that the only way to pray is kneeling. You'll find in Scripture that they often prayed standing and many times laying prostrate upon the ground. And consequently, there are many different ways that we can pray in position. But I think the indication is here scripturally that Daniel's kneeling here was a position that you would normally get in before one who was a person of great honor and respect, a king, for example. When you come into the presence of a king, it was always very customary to bow in his presence. So likewise, when we're speaking to the King of Kings, we can bow in his presence, and we ought to come very humbly before him, and knowing that we've got an audience with him is an honor in itself. Notice that little word, "he continued kneeling." He continued. It wasn't something that Daniel decides, "Now I'm going to show these guys how spiritual I am by doing this." You know, my girls here not too long ago were really getting on me because they said, "You know, Dad, we've noticed that whenever you have people from the church in the house, you're always more severe in your discipline on us than when they're not here." And, you know, that's really not right. That's inconsistent. And Daniel just is determined here that he's not going to change his previous habits at all. He's going to be consistent. And he's going to be consistent to the point that he was not going to change his prayer life or his devotional life. And even though these peeping Toms were standing right outside of his window, In fact, I almost called this message a sermon on the Peeping Toms and how Daniel's confrontation with the Peeping Toms, because it's really what he has here, a confrontation with the Peeping Toms. Now, the house was located so that at street level, it was very easy to look right inside the windows. The courtyard was right outside his window. And it wouldn't have been hard for them at all to look in the window and see Daniel there on his knees in the chamber. Continue kneeling three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God. Here we see a regular thing. Daniel's determined. He's in a position of great importance and respect, so he needs to spend all the more time with God in prayer. And that he does. Three times a day, which is another way of saying without ceasing, Daniel was praying. You know, the Lord really hit me with a passage this week that I really hadn't seen in this light before, but the question really came to me, why is it that so many of my prayers aren't answered? I don't know if you've ever wondered that. You know, you pray and you pray, and you wonder why God hasn't answered this person. By the way, you see me up here kind of gulping at times. I forgot to tell you, I extend greetings from Nene and her husband Tuck, who had us over at 4:30 this afternoon at the Terrells for a Vietnamese supper. And she had fixed some things that we had never seen before. And I hope Nene's not here, but I really don't care to see a couple of those things again. It was a fine meal. I loved the egg rolls, but there were a couple other items that didn't set too well with quite a few, but I understand their delicacy over in Vietnam. Anyway, I'm kind of, it's coming up a little bit. Daniel was praying and giving thanks. Anyway, let me get back on it here. Let me have you turn to 1 John 3:22. It finally dawns on me why so many of our prayers really aren't answered. You ever wonder why your prayers maybe aren't answered? Daniel really had a prayer life. I mean, everything that Daniel did kind of revolved around prayer. You remember back in Daniel chapter 2, where Daniel is wanting to know what the dream is so that his life isn't taken with all these other wise men and astrologers and conjurers? And Daniel and the other three Hebrew children, they seek the face of God and they pour out their lives before him. And God responds to that prayer of Daniel's. And it's the dream that is given to Daniel is a direct response from God to Daniel's prayer. Daniel really had a meaningful and effective prayer life. And it suddenly dawned on me in 1 John 3:22, whatever we ask, we receive from him. Wouldn't that be great if we could really say this with the Apostle John? Whatever we ask, we receive from him. Because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing in his sight. Now, those are the two prerequisites to having answered prayer and to be able to have this same thing happening in our lives, that God is answering prayer, those things that we ask of him, because we are obedient to his commandments, and secondly, we are doing those things which are pleasing in his sight. You see, not all of our activities are covered by commandments. There are commandments that very explicitly state how we're to conduct ourselves in different situations, and commandments that we know very easily can be broken. But on the other hand, there are a lot of gray areas, and in those gray areas of our lives, are we really seeking to do what God wants us to do and seeking to please him in everything? You know, the movies that you go to, do you really stop and think, is this pleasing in the sight of God for me to go? And I'm not preaching against all movies, but I'm just saying, do we really discern everything in that light? Is it really pleasing to the Lord? My conduct in this given situation, a certain habit that I have, is it pleasing in the sight of God? And if we're not seeking in everything to be pleasing to him, then we cannot blame God when he doesn't answer our prayers, because these are the two prerequisites for prayer. And you look at Daniel's life, it's really a perfect illustration of how this works out. Daniel is without fault, both in society and both in his relationship with God. He's seeking to do that which is pleasing in the sight of God, so consequently he has a very effective and meaningful prayer life. So in verse 11, these men come by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. In verse 12, they approach the king. The king answered and said, the statement is true according to the law of Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. And then notice in verse 13 how they refer to these three Hebrews. They answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah. not one of your close associates, one who you think very highly of, but he's just an exile, one of the exiles from Judah. He pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. As soon as the king hears this statement in verse 14, he's terribly distressed because he wants to deliver Daniel. His mind was set on delivering Daniel. And then finally, he sees no other way. So in verse 16, he gives the orders. Daniel is brought and cast into the lion's den. And consequently, we come into the third part of our outline tonight, and that is the result. Now, the lion's den, and I can only relate to you what one of the biblical encyclopedias say about this, it was a large square cavern under the earth, having a partition wall in the middle of it, furnished with a door, which the keeper can open and close from above. So it's a cavern in the earth that has a door above. It also has an iron gate that can be can go up and down in the midst of the cavern so that they can take the lions from one segment of that cavern and entice them by food in another area to get them over to this other area, close the gate, and then consequently they could clean the pens and feed the animals. The door would shut and they could enter and clean the chambers. The cavern was open above, and around the open part of the cavern at the top, right at the heart of the earth, there was a 4.5-foot wall, yard and a half wall, and over this wall one could look down and observe what is going on in the den. And then right in the midst of that wall there was a breaking point where there was a door from which you could enter down into the cavern, and the stone would be placed in that door. And this is the reason why the king was able to converse with Daniel the next morning. He doesn't sleep all during the night, and he's able to converse with Daniel the next morning because he's able to look right over that 4.5-foot wall and converse with Daniel there. So here we have the result. In verse 16, the king says, Daniel, may your God, whom you constantly serve, deliver you. This is not an expression of faith on the part of the king. No, not at all. He's just simply saying, may he deliver you. And the reason why we must take it this way in the Hebrew is because down in verse 20, the king speaks to Daniel the next morning, and he says, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? It's obvious the king didn't have a lot of faith, and that's why he was fretting so. He was more nervous and wasn't as cool about this whole thing as Daniel was. You'd have thought it had been just the opposite way around, wouldn't you? And oftentimes that's true. When we go into crises, an unbeliever is not going to respond, hopefully, the same way we respond. At least our response should be different because we realize the sovereign God, creator of all, is the one who's Lord of our circumstances and very much in control. And so Daniel's very cool about this whole thing. In verse 21, Daniel speaks to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, shut the lions' mouths that they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and so toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. The reason why God delivered Daniel in this set of circumstances is because Daniel sought to obey the commandments of God, to be obedient to him, and to do those things which were pleasing in the sight of God. Verse 23, the king was very pleased. He gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den, so Daniel was taken up out of the den. No injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Now there, to me, is the real point of all these sermons on crises. We have it right here, because he trusted in his God. Do we really believe that God's the one who's in control of our circumstances? Do we really believe that God is sovereign, that he's created these circumstances that we're going through? If we really believe that, and we believe God's in control, then God is going to deliver us because we trust in our God. There's a verse in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 33. It talks about the mouths of the lions being shut by faith. It's the great chapter on faith. And it was by Daniel's faith. I'm convinced that had Daniel not really believed that God was going to deliver him, Daniel may very well have not been delivered. But again, like this morning, you go back to Daniel chapter 1, you see how in that set of circumstances, God made Daniel and the three Hebrews far fairer and more choice as a result of their eating their own diet of vegetables than if they had eaten the king's food and wine. And so Daniel had seen the Lord respond in these little circumstances, and no doubt he was even aware of how the three Hebrews here were delivered from the midst of the firing furnace. And so even in these testimonies, Daniel was willing to step out and trust God by faith. And that's exactly what God is asking us to do on the basis of the testimonies that we have heard in Scripture, as well as the testimonies we hear from others, is that God is sufficient in any situation to get us through. It's during the wars between the Spanish and the French that the Spaniards had surrounded their foes, and they were insulting with notes the French commander, General Collignac. And one of the notes said, "Surrender, we are more numerous than you." The general wrote his reply on a piece of paper. He fastened it to an arrow and shot it back into the Spanish camp. And he said, "Surrender? Never. We have our king with us." And there's really a point there that we need to realize, that in all of our situations, like the three Hebrews this morning, our King is with us. Just as He parted the waters of the Red Sea in preparation for the people going through on dry land, God was right there with them in the pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. And likewise to the presence of His Holy Spirit, He's with His people today. And He's leading us. He goes with us. He never leaves us nor forsakes us. So the result in verses 25... "Then the Darius, the king, wrote to all the peoples, nations, languages, the men of every language who were living in all the land, 'May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel.'" Oh, through this action of Daniel, what a new respect these pagans get for the God of Daniel. And you know, likewise, and I think this is really in essence what God is doing in our lives today, is that through these crises, He's giving the world an opportunity to see how He is able to take care of His people in the midst of promise, that we don't crash like the world does in the same circumstances. "His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." And then notice verse 28. "So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian." These two men simultaneously reigning, Cyrus the great Persian leader, and under him was Darius, who was the king of the province of Babylon. I think it's a testimony again that in the midst of our circumstances, God has something good to come out of it. And it could be that there may be somebody here tonight that the very thing that God is doing in your life through your circumstances is to bring you to the point to where you realize you have a need for Him. And you've maybe never really trusted Jesus Christ. And so He's allowing you to go through the fiery furnace, as we mentioned this morning, or to be in the lion's den, as we mentioned tonight. And consequently, the Lord is using these crises to build character into your life as a believer, and you who may be here without Jesus Christ, to bring you to Him, to bring you to Himself. The Lord uses circumstances to bring us to Himself. How many testimonies have we heard over the weeks right here in our sanctuary? Testimonies of how God used crises, and the Lord had to use something really difficult to get through and drive the point home that we need Him. And that may be what the Lord's doing in your life. And I encourage you just to trust Christ tonight if you've never really done that.